Hello, welcome back to Therapy Insiders. I'm Dr. Gene Schirakabrad. Dr. Joe Palmer will not be joining us today. He's en route to a Las Vegas conference, so don't feel too bad for him. But Dr. Erson Religioso, Dr. E from themanualtherapist.com is here again. Dr. E, how you doing today?
I'm well, and you know, I have to tell you, because one of my buddies actually just started listening to the podcast news. He was happy to find me on here, but it's actually Religioso, and I know everyone, you can put it's not, you know, phonetically, you're not doing it incorrect, but it's more Spanish, so it's Religioso.
Well, it's good to know. Thanks for letting me know. I feel better now, and I'm
going
to practice. I'm going to practice this whole week in front of a mirror, Religioso.
Yeah, not like I could say Shirok or Broad any easier. I mean, this is, right now, this is the podcast of PTs with difficult-to-pronounce last names.
That's very true, but I'm going to practice every day for at least 10 seconds a day.
10 seconds.
I'm going to knock it out next week.
Well, I don't know if you know this, but it takes 10,000 hours to say my name correctly to be a pro at it.
10,000 hours?
Yes, you know the 10,000-hour theory, right?
I thought it was about 2,000 or 3,000 repetitions of something.
Oh, I don't know. I usually hear the hours thing, you know. Any pro athlete or pro musician, whatever, practiced at least 10,000 hours.
Right.
Which, you
know, it's rest assured that I will do neither.
Okay.
I will devote 10 seconds.
I believe it. 10 seconds for you is like 10,000 hours for someone else.
That's true. I'm very precise in what I do.
Yeah.
So speaking of precision, we've had some interesting comments, some awesome comments, I think, from our previous podcast when we talked about the C-spine. And one that kind of, I think, was the antithesis of it all was on our Therapy Insiders Pod website. And it's from a listener, Elliot. And so he, just to kind of paraphrase, he said that, you know, he's used special tests before, and it kind of is a bit of a jumbled mess. Sometimes it affects the treatment, sometimes it doesn't, but essentially just takes up time. And in our previous podcast, we talked about neck pain, and I made a point to mention that we're dealing with a case without radicular or any kind of paresthesias to eliminate any serious pathologies. So his question was, does it really matter if they have paresthesias or radicular symptoms? Because the outcome and the goal should be the same, right? Symmetrical movement, symmetrical strength, return to function. So I think that's a great discussion, and I think it really leads into what we're going to cover this podcast is differential diagnosis and how does a identification of a pathology guide your treatment. And in this case, neck pain, does it matter if it's a mechanical joint issue versus a acute HNP with radicular symptoms or kind of nerve irritation. So I think there's two different approaches to this. And Dr. E and I were kind of talking about this before, is the majority of the people being more illness script or differential diagnosis or diagnosis driven. And then there's more of a, I'd say, more modern approach to manual therapy. And I think Dr. E, I'll let you cover that, and I think that's your evolution of manual therapy, the way that you've been practicing, and I think it holds a lot of weight in the outcomes that you get.
Right. I mean, I would just say that, you know, even David Butler put it succinctly at the beginning of a study. I don't know, I forget the exact quote, but it's the therapist who has the best interaction with the patient, or the most positive interaction, will get the best outcomes. And that's regardless of whether you follow biomechanics and pathoanatomy and your explanations are, you know, right on right and left on left, or facet versus disc. And because basically, if you're a very interactive, compassionate individual and you interact with the patient, you spend quality time with them, I think you're going to have positive outcomes no matter what. I just evolved and moved along in my practice based on what modern pain science tells us and the research on, you know, whether or not how scans affect someone's outcomes and what that makes them do, how that raises their you know, their anxiety and their fear avoidance, and also what what MDT tells us and what movement systems like the SFMA do to streamline our approach versus the typical kind of special tests, or for any of the DCs kind of listening to this podcast, if there are indeed any.
Everybody listens.
Yes.
Millions of people.
What they call ortho testing. So, you know, does it really make a difference? That's my ultimate question. Any of the tests that you do, or anything that you do during an evaluation, how does it affect your treatment?
So when I was trained, the big emphasis was on subjective, right? You should have a fairly clear picture, 80% confidence of what you're dealing with before you even touch the person, before you do special tests. So I did a lot of my training with Jim Meadows, and he's very biomechanical based, but he has a very strong differential diagnosis leaning as well, right? So based on the questions you ask, it's essentially you come up with three questions that you want to ask, you know, after you talk to the person, and you have a hypothesis. You develop this hypothesis, and you do everything in your power to prove yourself wrong, you know, because that you want to eliminate bias. Right. And I think it's the opposite in a lot of instances. Is you have a differential diagnosis and you have an idea what it is and you try to prove yourself right, which is, mm-hmm. I think, the way a lot of people think with special tests is we need to do this to rule something in. And you instantly bias your treatment. So when I'm doing, and I still think in differential diagnosis, because like you and I talked about, it's kind of ingrained in me, but I don't necessarily always let it drive my treatment. So if somebody has, let's say, going back to that C-spine, has a radicular symptom, like we talked about, into the, let's say, the scapular, mid-scapular region, will I do the manipulation sometimes? Sure, if it's dictated in the treatment and my palpation and the soft tissue and how the person's responding. Doesn't mean I always follow the clinical prediction rules, which a lot of them I'm honestly not a huge fan of. But it all depends on the patient presentation of what we're seeing. And so I think that's kind of a little bit of the more of the historic differential diagnosis and a little bit of that of the streamline approach, even though the thought process in when you're dealing with streamline is you're really just looking at the motion and the symmetry and picking out what the movement dysfunction is versus really focusing on the diagnosis. Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, even when I was trained classically in pathoanatomy from the University of St. Augustine, and literally they get around to looking at movement somewhere around like step 15 of their 20-step evaluation. You're supposed to treat the dysfunction causing the pain and not treat the pain. And you know, they said that only Maitland practitioners and McKenzie practitioners treated the pain, which that ended up being a better approach anyway. At least it's easier. You know, it has less clinical decisions to make. But my question for anyone, whether it's in my courses or even to you, Gene, so let's say a shoulder patient walks in and, you know, they have a painful arc and maybe they don't have any mechanism of injury like many of them do not. And typically, I think the average therapist would think, well, this could be a rotator cuff tinnitus, this could be an impingement of some sort, could be coming from the neck. And in the end, though, whether it's any of those things, you might end up doing the same treatment, or you might end up doing different treatments. But by and large, a lot of the treatments are the same. Might be a little C-spine work, might be a little thoracic work, might be a little glenohumeral work, and essentially you're stretching what needs to be stretched, you're moving what needs to be moved, and you're strengthening or stabilizing what needs to be facilitated or strengthened. And no matter what the diagnosis is. Would you say that's true?
Yeah, I think what you're describing is essentially pattern recognition and putting together kind of a plan in your mind, whether it's based on experience or training, of what these different clusters that you're seeing are presenting as, whether it's C-spine, T-spine, or shoulder issues. So if I see, you know, I don't know, 2,000 patients with a similar limitations in their arc of motion, and they come in, you know, 500, let's say, come in with a MD diagnosis of frozen shoulder, and another 500 come in with a diagnosis of shoulder pain, which is...
Right, that's a great diagnosis.
I love those diagnoses. Shoulder pain, low back pain.
Yeah.
difficulty walking, which I guess is an actual diagnosis for Medicare, but yeah, but you know, it's that kind of stuff. You see, it's not every arc of motion is the same. Not every arc of motion limitation, I should say, is the same. And you can kind of see, oh, that their T-spine isn't really extending, or yeah, they're kind of elevating the whole shoulder girdle. And I think that's what makes us good, or should make a good manual therapist, is the ability to discern the dysfunction in the movement, and from that have an idea of what you're going to target your treatments towards, versus saying, okay, they have pain over the deltoid area, that's got to be rotator cuff problem, so we're going to treat the rotator cuff without looking at the T-spine, without looking at the C-spine. I think that's a big problem.
Yeah, I would say that's definitely a problem, and I think many therapists just look at, and even, of course, many MDs, you know, some comes with knee pain, some comes with shoulder pain, they just end up with an injection to that area without looking at anything else, because it's just purely treating by symptoms. But in the end, we should be looking at movements of the area that's painful, or what I call the, you know, you're trying to put out the fire, because they're coming in for shoulder pain, and that's the fire. But you want to also take care of any little piles of dried leaves or burning embers that might be all around the area, which in this case could be the C-spine, the T-spine, could be the elbow, it could be the opposite hip, potentially, if they are, you know, a rotational athlete or pretty much anyone who moves a lot. You know, that's why I like treatments or assessments like the SFMA and MDT, repeated motions exam, because they cut down on your clinical decision making, and they directly lead you to a treatment versus your standard, you know, when I was a student, or even when I was finished with fellowship, just 2 years after I graduated, it was, you know, what are the 20 special tests I'm going to do on this shoulder. And 6 or 7 years later, I really realized no matter what the test told me, I was either just provoking it or alleviating it. And in the end, I'm still doing similar manual treatments.
Right.
And your outcomes are the same, except for maybe the patient likes you better because you're not provoking them.
I can't even remember, aside from, you know, doing a VBI test or Aller ligament or a Sharpe's purser or a Hoffman's test for C-spine issues, and even those I do when, you know, when I really think they are needed, not just for the sake of doing it, even though a lot of people do them for liability reasons. I can't remember the last time I actually did special tests for the sake of helping me figure out what I'm going to do or what the treatment's going to be. And kind of similar to you, I think the analogy that I use a lot with my patients, which is also a fire analogy, which is funny, is I say, you know, if you have a building with three floors and all three floors are on fire, if I run in and put the fire out on the third floor and run out congratulating myself, I haven't really done anything. It's still going to spread. And then I usually follow it up with, after you do some treatments, is when people feel better, it's, you know, it's kind of easy to get you to feel good. It's hard to keep you that way. And I think that all kind of ties into, you know, there's nothing wrong with treating the pain, because people come in to you with pain. It's not treating the pain every single time. It's, you know, treat the pain, make them feel better, and then start to break down what's really going on and the movement dysfunctions in the people, because that's our job, right? Our job is to get people moving and restore function.
Right. And especially when dealing with some of the chronically, you know, centrally sensitized patients, you may never get rid of their pain, and you may only be able to improve their function. And that's the hardest part about treating those patients, is that they have no diagnosis because everything is negative. Their blood work is negative. Their scans are sometimes perfect, and yet their nervous system has gone haywire and permanently set their movement and pain thresholds low, so that everything is a threat. And you know, that's a diagnosis that's hard to swallow, because it doesn't, like the fibromyalgia is, they go online and they see that there's no hope, essentially, for their pain. And there's just a bunch of other sufferers they see on forums, and that's really hard. And there's no easy answer for that. But I don't want the listeners or any of my blog readers to think that I'm so far removed from biomechanics and pathoanatomy that I don't think differential diagnosis is not helpful at all. Because I do think it's helpful in the case of when someone is not improving or when someone does not fall into the 80% rapid responding category that I often talk about. And, you know, whether it's 80%, 70%, it's still a majority of your patients. But there will be patients who don't respond. And again, even though I'm not a huge fan of meta-analyses, because you can take any, you know, you can take a bunch of randomized clinical trials and put them together and find, and sure, it does have more statistical weight, but it doesn't necessarily tell you what's going on in the clinic. But in terms of red flags, what a meta-analysis found, or systematic review, I'm not sure which one it was, so the only ones that really mattered was a previous history of cancer and then a failure to improve within 4 weeks. And I do think that those are very good guidelines that people should follow. You know, none of the other guidelines in terms of unremitting night pain or three regions of spinal pain that we all kind of learned as Stoddard's warning signs, they were found not to be significant in terms of true pathology. But I would say, regardless of the diagnosis you have in your head, or what you may or may not have told your patient, you should really make some sort of change within 3 to 4 weeks. And when you're looking at zero changes within 3 to 4 weeks, it's very unlikely you are going to have any positive effect on this patient. I mean, if you're an experienced therapist, and maybe even some of you new grads who are at least 2 years out or so, I'd like you to count on your hand how many times you ever made a significant change in a patient after 4 weeks, or, you know, after 6 or 7 weeks. It's very rare.
Excluding post-surgical.
Right. Well, that's an expected, yeah. Other than patients with an expected healing rate, I'm more just talking about a patient just comes in with insidious pain.
Right.
You know, someone who doesn't need healing, someone who didn't have any kind of physical trauma or man-made trauma, which is essentially what surgery is.
Yeah, it's funny to kind of backtrack a little bit, hearing the Stoddard name. And for any of those that aren't familiar with that name, Alan Stoddard was one of the fathers of manual therapy. He was a DO, I believe. And that was one of the first manual therapy books I read. Erson, believe it or not, it was out of print already. And when I started PT school, I knew I wanted to do manual therapy. So I always bugged our professor that taught manual therapy. So I told him, you know, give me something to read. So he told me Stoddard. And I read that book cover to cover. I still have it in black and white and all that. And that's a lot of foundation in that for manual therapy in terms of the biomechanical type of approach to it. It's an interesting read. If you find one of the old Stoddard manual therapy manuals, I'd definitely recommend it. If you're into it, then you have the Greenmans that came from that. And it's an interesting history of manual therapy.
Right. Right. And my whole point was basically, even though some of those red flags that we learned, like general feeling of malaise or, you know, basically a patient not feeling well other than just their pain. I mean, low energy. We may not be able to have a differential diagnosis for that. But again, if you're seeing zero changes within 3 weeks or so, I always tell my patients, if I make zero changes in anything, even range or something very simple like strength, not even pain, but we make zero changes even 2 visits, that's my leash. Because my patients are cash-based, and I'm typically only seeing them once a week. That's already 2 weeks have gone by, and I probably already tried a decent amount of things within 2 whole hours of treatment. And I only continue seeing them if we even make the slightest change, unless it's someone who I expect to have very, very slow progress, like a centrally sensitized patient, you know, fibromyalgia, chronic whiplash, or just a frozen shoulder even. I mean, obviously that's someone who needs true tissue changes, so you can't do anything rapidly.
Right. Yeah, it's so we're trying to cover and paint a picture for you guys of different approaches to treatment and thought process of it. I don't think in any way, because I think in differential diagnosis, a differential diagnosis to me is a mind map. So the way I was taught and the way I learned was you have categories, and it, Jim called them illness scripts, and I know that's how physicians are taught, is you have a pathology, and from that you have kind of like a spider web of symptoms and things you would expect. And it all kind of falls into categories, right? There's only so many things it can be before it's not in our scope. It's going to be segmental issue. It's going to be a tendinopathy. It's going to be an instability, like a spondylo or something of that sort. Traumatic events, headaches, tension headaches. It's going to be, BPPV. And there's a bunch of these categories that are, you learn. And as the person's telling you their story, you kind of get these flags. And you move stuff around in your mind, at least I do. And so then I have two or three, hopefully just two, by the time they're done talking, and I could ask, two or three questions and start doing my exam. And the exam, and if you're not doing this in your treatment, regardless of what it is, if you're not having your patient walk or actually move in some way, I think you're doing the patient a huge disservice because you need to see how their whole body moves, regardless of what the dysfunction is. I don't know if you agree or disagree with that, Erson, but every single patient that comes in to see me, they're always walking before and after treatment because I need to see how the whole body moves. I think that's always an important sticking point for me.
I have most of my patients walk, especially the lower quarter patients, and sometimes I film them running on a treadmill if they're runners or athletes in slow motion from all planes. A lot of my upper quarter TMJ and headache patients, I don't necessarily see them walk for the most part. I always walk them back to the table because I go out and get them and I walk with them and I always make an observation there quickly. But for the most part, the SFMA covers gross movement patterns. And unless someone is a sedentary office worker, I typically do all the top tier, which is the seven movements. And there's a deep squat, and I usually add single leg squat too, and then a single limb stance. And so you do get a good idea of how they're moving. But I will stick to the upper quarter for sedentary office workers, or the lower quarter for sedentary office workers, or just sedentary people in general. Because people basically who move less are technically at less risk for injury with their asymmetries because they just don't have a chance to possibly accumulate any kind of peripheral strain that will add up
Yeah, so
over a period of
you're
time.
doing a movement screen anyway, so it essentially is a similar effect to what we're trying to
Right.
accomplish.
Right.
But yeah, I'm not I haven't done any of the SFMA. I've looked at chunks of it, and I do like some of the parts of it, but it as a whole, I don't know if I'm a big fan of the whole thing. But
Yeah.
there's definitely parts that I like a lot.
The whole thing is rather robust and it's almost too much. I mean, similar to any approach that I've ever learned, and I think most people do this, very few people are very dogmatic in what they learn from a particular commercial model. You just take what is very useful to you and you kind of discard the rest for whatever reason. Maybe it wasn't useful to you, or maybe you just never bothered to learn it. But you just take what is practical for you. And I certainly don't do the whole algorithmic thing because it's just crazy to look at in
Right.
terms of like the flow sheets, but it does give you a very good idea of how the patient overall is moving. And I think something like that, and the reason why I talk about that, I don't really think about what is wrong with this patient. And it's something I recently wrote about in my blog. There's the why, the what, and the how. And patients are often they're often waiting for me at the end, what's the diagnosis? And I usually say, look, I'd just be giving you an educated guess, and that's all it would be from anyone on what your diagnosis is, even whether you got a scanner or not. And oftentimes a scan is just bad news. So in
And that's
terms of
only
what,
backfired on you once.
yes, only once that I talked about anyway. But
True. Not to
that was
bring
not
that
in
up
the
again or anything.
right, yes. I only think about it every day. But the why it happened is sometimes not obvious because it may have not been a particular trauma or an event. The what is what is currently happening might be certain movements or certain perceptions of how your nervous system is guarding the area or not letting it move, or how pain is affecting your motor control. But I always present the question, and very few people take this the wrong way. When you look at those two questions, like what is the most important is how I can show you to help yourself, basically. If I can show you how and what to do to help yourself and assess yourself and treat yourself, would you care about why it happened or what exactly is the diagnosis? Because in the end, the diagnosis, We don't change a diagnosis. We don't change a rotator cuff tear. We don't change an HNP. If there's a nerve root protrusion, or if there's a nerve root getting pinched by a protruding disc, sometimes we can affect that via repeated motions, according to some MDT studies in lumbar spine, not so much in a cervical spine. And, you know, the way I educate people away from pathoanatomy is most people have intermittent pain, where your pain comes and goes, or even if it's not truly intermittent and it never gets down to zero, but it's variable, that means your nervous system has different varying levels of threat, certain positions, motions, and even the context of an area or an environment or what you think about a certain, you know, activity is going to affect the way your nervous system sets your thresholds for pain and movement. So if we can just continuously reset that alarm to keep your pain and movement thresholds high, regardless of what's going on, you will feel better and your scans will continue to look the same, which is usually just not great because you already received bad news.
Yeah. And that, I think that's a, that out of all is a great point, is that it's the nervous system is variable every day, right? And it's listening to the patient about what they're telling you, because sometimes when they come in, it's in a different state of healing or reestablishing the neural pathways. And so going back to Elliot's question of, does it really matter? Does the differential, not differential diagnosis, which is what it amounts to, but does a referred symptom or does radicular symptom, does it really matter in the end goal of your treatment? And to me, if it helps in me ruling out certain diagnoses, and by diagnoses I mean pathologies, right? So if the patient is sitting there with, I think we were talking about left side bending restriction, if they're sitting stuck in left side bending and every time they try to turn their head and they have extreme pain, that's a little bit different than somebody's kind of has mid to end range pain and no numbness or tingling down the arm. Will it change my treatment? A little bit, but it's not going to change it any more than me putting my hands on the person and seeing what's going on and how they respond. So that, to me, it helps. It's a mind map for me to take me certain steps before I even get to touching the patient. And Dr. Yi is similar yet different.
Yeah, I mean, I think what you're describing is pretty similar, because you're even talking about pathology, but I don't look at it as, say, even a different pathology or a different diagnosis. I just look at it as potentially this patient may be more difficult if they have pain below the elbow or pain below the knee, or if it's been pain below the elbow or below the knee for a longer period of time. I mean, going back to something like a Quebec Task Force type classification or even a clinical prediction rules, which, you know, basically what they do is they identify a healthier population that mostly see chiros. You know, we get the patients that are not acute facet locks or whatever they are, that just come in with like, oh, I slept wrong.
God, I love those.
Yeah, oh, but we don't really get those. You know, the people who fall into the clinical prediction rules, typically they go to their chiros, because if you wake up and you have a foot drop and you're laterally shifted and you're like losing bowel and bladder control, you see your doctor and then they put you on bed rest for 6 weeks and then they're like, oh, you should probably try PT now. And, you know, according to McKenzie, you can't even correct a lateral shift after 6 weeks because of permanent tissue changes are starting to happen. And either that or it's very, very difficult or it's not correctable by MDT.
You just described a typical weekend in Vegas.
Right. Yeah. So, yeah, I don't really look at them as pathologies, but of course there are presentations that I see that make me think, or some things that the patients say, like they can't find any position or movement that alleviates their complaints. Or they're very, very insistent on having true constant pain, because most people confuse pain with every movement or pain for most of the day as constant versus, you know, first waking up in the morning and you don't really feel it, but every other time after you get out of bed, you feel it. That's still not constant to me, because I'm always looking for a patient to say that it's intermittent, and I can tell that intermittent is great news. But I do know there are patient presentations and certain things they tell me that make them worse, or how long they've had their pain, or how many areas they have their pain, that may make me think this is going to be a little bit more difficult than your average patient.
Right. And that is a comfort in your skill set. I think that comes with, and trust me, when I say this, experience is not everything, because there's a difference between experience and good experience. But when you do have good experience and good training and you can be comfortable in that thought process, it becomes extremely helpful. And for our younger listeners, or less experienced, meaning recently out of school, when you're in school or when you just start practicing, that's kind of your comfort blanket, is being very kind of compartmentalized, I guess, spit that word out, compartmentalized in your thought process of what the patient is presenting with, because it makes it more comfortable for you to treat them. It's a bit of a security blanket in the way you think about how I'm going to approach this treatment, which is fine. It's good to have an idea of what the patient has, but as you evolve and as you see that sometimes it might not be the most efficient way to look at a patient, I think the way Dr. E is describing, Dr. Rilly Hioso, how do you like that?
Pretty good.
Thank you. Kind of hurt my throat a little bit. You see that it becomes a very quick, efficient approach to looking at your patient. And you can still think like I do. You can still think in differential diagnosis. It's still a comfort blanket for me, because I like to, in my mind, know what the pathology is that I'm treating and go about it. But does it change anything? Not really. Maybe 5% of the time it does. But yes, the end goal is active symmetrical motion to end range, symmetrical strength, and restoration of function.
Yeah. The pathology basically for me, or the differential, changes things when we can't treat it. That for me, that's when it changes things. But if you think of things like PFS or medial collateral ligament sprain, or a patellofemoral or patellar tendonitis, in the end, you're still looking for dysfunctions to treat and things to strengthen or stabilize. So no matter what, when the patient's like, "Oh, what do I have? I have knee pain." I'm like, "Well, you have knee pain, essentially, because that's all we really know. But this is what your movement is telling me, and this is how I think you can self-treat it after I'm done helping you move better."
Yeah, and it's also helping the patient understand the difference between knee pain and pain around the knee. That's also, I think that, again, if you're doing differential diagnosis, that once you figure things out and explaining it to patients, and like you said, coming back and actually explaining to the patient what they have and what the problem could be, I think that's huge. Versus patients get these diagnoses a lot of times and go to Dr. Google right away, and they look, the script says shoulder pain, and they Google shoulder pain, and they come into you and they go, what's this tumor that Google's talking
Right.
about?
Yeah,
Is it
basically, all things on WebMD lead to cancer,
Penco's tumor? What does that mean?
Yeah.
And so it's your job. And a patient kind of spill a lot of things to me a couple days ago, and he goes, "Man, this really is like a therapy session." I was like, "Well, I guess that's a therapist and physical therapist, because it's, you're spending 2, 3 days a week or times a week with a patient, and what other medical provider gets to do that?" So
Right.
you have to build that up with the patient as well, and that goes back to your first quote from Butler.
Yeah. I think we are very fortunate that way. A quick story I do want to share, though, in terms of Dr. Google. I had a patient who I was certain she was, her most of her shoulder pain was coming from her cervical spine, and probably about maybe we got 70%, 80% of it better doing mostly cervical stuff. And we started on a little bit of shoulder, but I was and I, I just started treating her thoracic spine, and she started even improving then. She kept on asking me, "When are we going to address my shoulder? When are we going to address my shoulder?" And I said, "We're going to start to look at your shoulder when I think that this is really plateaued, because I think we still have a couple more visits to go, and we haven't really finished treating your neck and your mid back." So she comes back and she's like, "Look, I know you don't like this, but I went online and I found a couple of videos of some exercises that really, really helped my shoulder." And I basically cut her right off, and I said, "Look, I told you I don't want you to throw any more ingredients in my soup, because I'm the chef and it just could totally ruin the recipe." And she's like, "They were your videos." I was like, "Oh, she found my YouTube channel and, you know, she saw a couple of my shoulder resets and that pretty much made her 100%. So
nice.
It's like, well,
you who got might, who might smacked argue with, down by yourself.
Who might argue with that guy?
Hmm. That's a, that, I think that's more of an existential problem.
Yeah.
That's, that hurts my head thinking about it. That's,
what the hell does he know?
Yeah. What does that guy even know?
That was me a year ago. You know how much I've learned since then?
I've learned how to cook two new soups.
That's right.
All right. So I hope you guys found that useful. And I'd say our challenge to you guys to think about is how do you approach an initial evaluation when somebody comes in? Are you differential diagnosis based? Are you movement based? Are you a hybrid of the two? Let us know. Leave us a comment. Leave us a comment on iTunes, on therapyinsiderspod.com. More than manualtherapist.com with Dr. Yi. I know he posts questions like that quite often on his blog. So check it out. Let us know. And we'll post it on Reddit as well. So check it out there. And we want to, you know, we want to hear what you guys think and see a discussion on this topic, because I know it's a very prominent type of thought process out there.
Right. And you know, my final closing question would be, not only, Clay asked it before, not only every test or every passive test or special test or ortho test, but even if you're into movement testing like I am, whether it's repeated motions or FMS or SFMA, you should also be asking yourself, what is this movement going to tell me? It's not just the tests that I'm slamming. It's everything you're doing should lead you to a treatment. And if you find that something is not consistently leading you to a treatment or cutting down your clinical decision making, I challenge you to abandon that and see if your outcomes are any worse. Because when I started just dropping things left and right, because I definitely have dropped most of what I have learned over the years in lieu of a simplistic approach, my outcomes are probably better, but I think it's because I have more time to actually treat the patient rather than just test the patient.
Yeah, it's all about having the time to do the most effective things for your patient, and figuring that out is huge. You know, that's, courses are built on that, and a lot of businesses are made on that, or vice versa, not. So leave us some comments. We've appreciated all the feedback that we've had and the interesting discussions, whether it's, again, on Reddit or on our various social media sites. So you can find us on therapyinsiderspod.com, on iTunes. Keep sending us comments. You know, we love these comments, and turns into more discussions for us to talk about. Definitely check out Dr. E's website, themanualtherapist.com, the Edge Mobility Systems. By the way, I've been using the Edge a lot more for ASTM, and it's been getting pretty good. Pretty good results. I'm pretty happy with it. And I've been coming up. I've been, speaking of cooking more exercises with those Edge mobility bands. And that, I don't know if you've seen the video yet, the core stability video that I posted on my ARC website at goarcnow.com and on Reddit and various other places. The one exercise we did with the lean back with the Edge mobility bands, man, that thing really gets you for a few days.
Yeah, I have yet to try it. It looked pretty rough. I noticed it wasn't you doing it, Gene, but maybe because Maureen is a bit more photogenic than you are.
Well, it's because I'm excellent with the camera, that's why.
Oh, I see. Steady hand.
That's right. I have the eye.
Good framing.
Very nice good framing.
Nice lighting.
Yeah, yeah, it's all about the lighting.
Yeah.
So thanks for listening this week for me and Dr. Religioso. I had to warm myself up to that. I did like the tongue exercises before I actually said it.
Right. If you can roll your R's, you actually be one step ahead of me. I could never roll my R's despite 5 years of Spanish.
Yeah, I'll have to practice. That'll be part of my 10 seconds. Yeah. And for Dr. Joe Palmer, who couldn't join us this week for his conference in Vegas, although if you stay tuned to the end of this podcast, you might hear a special robot voice of Joe Palmer as an outtake from last podcast. And I'd say don't miss it, because it was fantastically terrifying.
Yes, it was.
So thanks for listening, and we'll catch you guys next week.
All right. Have a good day or night.
Oh, my God. So, Joe, how do you commonly treat neck pain?
Well, that's very interesting. Yes. It's Joe's views on literal mechanical neck pain. He's actually treating other cyborgs. And that's